stories don't define you. How you tell them will. Hi, I'm Sarah Elkins, your host and chief story maker of Elkins Consulting.
When we share stories, whether in our personal or business lives, how we share them makes a difference in how we remember them and in how we're perceived by the people we're sharing them with. When you're listening to this podcast, I encourage you to listen and consider your own related stories. To listen and think about which stories in your life might have impacted you in a similar way. And think about how you share those stories and the messages they carry for you and for the people who are hearing them. As usual, I find my guests in the best places. And this time I found Susan Lindner through an introduction through Joe Kwan. And Joe Kwan is a mutual connection of ours. And we both just find him to be so terrific. And so I'm just grateful, as usual, for the great introduction. And then Susan and I had a conversation just to meet each other last week, and I asked her if she'd be a guest on my podcast because she has so many great stories to share and really important, inspiring messages. So, Susan, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh my gosh, Sarah, thank you so much for having me. This is going to be so much fun.
I love this. It's like the best excuse for interesting conversations is to have a podcast.
Yeah, we need them now more than ever.
We do. We do. That kind of stimulation is really important, especially if we have kids at home. But or if we're all on our own, I think even more importantly than if I'm really feeling for people that are by themselves and really isolated right now. Because I don't know. I don't know that would be something that would be a comfortable situation for me. I doubt it. So I would love to hear just a little introduction. Just the basics. What do you do and what do you love about them? And then if you could share something about yourself that most people don't know about you, that would be a great start.
So let's see. I am a cultural anthropologist. I am a brand marketer and I am an innovation storyteller. I got my start really understanding the art and science of storytelling when I was working in brothels in Thailand doing HIV education with prostitutes and their johns. And so understanding how to tell stories that change behavior was my primary motivation. And then figuring out how to change behavior in the corporate world and in the marketing world, how to change market behavior my desire to put that into work. So what's something that Google doesn't know about me?
That might be hard.
Let's see. I was a hip hop DJ in 1989 at my college radio station. I had the Saturday morning 8 a.m. shift, the least desirable shift on the rotation.
Oh my gosh.
And the only calls I would get as a hip hop DJ were from the Cumberland County Correctional Facility, where all of the inmates loved my show and would occasionally ask for my personal phone number.
Of course they would.
So that's something Google doesn't know about me.
Oh my gosh, that's such a good story. You totally caught me off guard with that one. That is awesome. If you had caught me doing anything at 8 a.m. on a Saturday in 1989, it would have been because I was up the night before out dancing and drinking with my friends.
Yes, I often stumbled in from those nights with two bowls from the cafeteria upstairs of Cap'n Crunch to lay down next to the turntables, and I would eat Cap'n Crunch while the records played. And that was my morning ritual Saturday morning.
So awesome. So tell me, what was the hip hop album that you used the most that you would put on because it would make you feel like you, like this was important, like it mattered?
Oh my God, so many. My mind is exploding right now. You know, there was a classic old school Sugar Hill Gang, right? Oh. That Hotel Motel Holiday Inn, you know, that kind of.
Oh my God, I love that one.
Or certainly Run DMC. I was a big proponent of all the female artists at the time, Queen Latifah and MC Light.
Salt and Pepper.
Oh, of course. Yeah, absolutely. So I was a big proponent of those early female rappers.
Oh my gosh, I love that story. I have the biggest smile on my face right now. That is so much better than my college job story, which is I was a Sunday school teacher at the synagogue in Fort Collins, Colorado, my freshman year of college. And
wow.
After the third time, I called in for a substitute because it was 9 a.m. on a Sunday. They said, okay, either you need to take this seriously or you need to stop. And I'm like, okay, I'll start showing up. And the irony was that I worked at restaurants a lot in that time as well. That was, you know, where I actually made any money at all. And I will never forget when I interviewed with one of the restaurants and I told them, they saw my resume and it had this Sunday school teacher on it. Apparently that manager had told everyone in the restaurant that I was a Sunday school teacher without explaining that it was a Jewish Sunday school, which is different, let me tell you, from what I experienced with my friends that went to Christian Sunday schools. But the first few weeks that I worked in this restaurant, people were just on eggshells around me. They wouldn't say the things that I always heard in restaurants. And they were just super careful around me because I had been a Sunday school teacher. And I was so puzzled. I thought, this is the only restaurant I've ever been in where they're so polite and nice and there's no dirty humor. This is crazy. I think I was 20. And I remember one time I was reaching up for something and there was a guy down below me getting something out of a lower cabinet. And I snarkily, without thinking about it, because of all my years in the restaurant, I'd been in restaurants for 5 years already. I looked down at him and I smiled and smirked and said, well, while you're down there. And he must have nearly had a heart attack coming from a Sunday school teacher to have that. And he literally fell down onto his butt because he'd been squatting down. And he fell down on his butt and looked at me with his eyes huge. And he said, did you just say that out loud? And I said, oh, I did. Sorry. Was that insulting? He goes, but you're a Sunday school teacher. And then it all came clear about why people were on their best behavior around me. But anyway, terrible, terrible story. I like your DJ story so much better. So how long did you do that? Just for the year 89?
Yeah, I did it. Yeah, exactly. That was my sophomore year. And then my junior year, I left to Costa Rica and studied for my junior year abroad in Costa Rica and had the wonderful experience of hitchhiking from Costa Rica through the war in Nicaragua and El Salvador through 5 other countries all the way up to the border with Mexico.
Wow. Wow. I thought I was adventurous, but Susan, we have a lot to talk about, my friend. That's awesome. Because while you were finishing up your sophomore first semester, I was studying abroad in Australia and did not have the hitchhiking experience you did, but I did hitchhike through New Zealand by myself. So we have a lot of juicy stuff to talk about. But I really want to focus on the first thing we talked about during our conversation before, which is innovation storytelling. I love that our audience has all this context around you and your adventurous spirit because it contributes so greatly when it comes to storytelling and personal brand and the fact that you can't separate your personal and professional lives anymore. So tell me a little bit about what drew you into innovation storytelling. I'm sure it has something to do with cultural anthropology because there's that connection is so strong.
There is. You know, my greatest inspiration was a Polish anthropologist named Bronisław Malinowski. His first claim to fame was getting lost on his way to Australia. And because it was World War I, and because he was at the time a British citizen, at the time he was a Czech citizen, he wasn't allowed into Australia as a co-combatant with the Germans. So he had to take a side trip to Papua New Guinea.
Oh,
and wound up doing his field work in Papua New Guinea. And because no real work had been done there before, there wasn't a canon of literature that he could study or draw from. And so he realized that the only way to truly understand a culture was to live with the people, eat with the people, sleep with, argue with, get in fights with, make repairs with, you know, really begin to understand the culture from the inside out. And that science is what we called participant observation. It's the only way to really understand something is to get in deep, get your hands dirty, make relationships with people, and then draw your conclusions. And this is a wholly different way of looking at the social sciences, which were usually academics sitting in the ivory tower, kind of just conjecturing on people, often from a huge moralistic and racial and classist standpoint, right? About whether or not those cultures were valuable or added something into society.
Well, and just for a quick interruption, the other aspect of it is the whole idea at that time where they were trying to decide whether observation changed behavior, much less participation would change behavior, so that there's always that other side of it. So keep going.
For sure. For sure. As is evidenced with reality TV right now.
Oh, don't even get me started.
Okay.
Talk about participation.
Pleasure. So Bronislaw Malinowski wound up influencing every other realm of social science. The open door policy in the office today is the result of participant observation, walking down the hallway, stepping at people's desks and saying, hey, how's it going? Can I sit in on your team meeting? All of that is a direct descendant of Bronislaw. And it has gone on to influence every social science, every business and management insights about how we interact with people. And so that participant observation is also my impetus for going to Southeast Asia and recognizing at the height of the AIDS crisis. So this is 1994 Thailand. When I first arrived in my village in northern Thailand, the first red light district had already gone out of business because the sex workers and their customers had largely died from HIV. But following the law of supply and demand, another red light district opened right down the block. And it was becoming, again, another hotspot, a vector for HIV transmission. And so there was no AZT. There was no drug cocktail at the time. When I got to the hospital first, there was one room for quarantine patients with HIV. By the time I left 2 years later, there was one room for patients without HIV. So just to let you know how rampant the epidemic was at the time where I was living. And, you know, it feels there are so many parallels for me right now in the midst of COVID of what's going on. But around the storytelling, the predominant ethos from the Ministry of Public Health was giant billboards and posters that would say, get AIDS and die. Oh. And that was the message. Use a condom or die. Abstain or die, use a clean needle or die. And as a communicator, it's really difficult to have the stakes in the communication be so high that you have nowhere else to go. What we found was that form of storytelling, right? Get AIDS and die, actually worked for a time.
Well, you see that in meth ads, that shock, the shocking style of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so shock and awe campaigns do work. They just don't last. And what we found is that they worked for about 6 months, and then we saw the infection rates start to climb again. Like most of us are getting a little sick and tired of being indoors, right?
We wearing a mask.
To walk around without a mask. Well, I've been safe all this time. Why do I have to use them now? Right? The same philosophy holds true. This is human nature. It's not new to public health. So what does any good marketer do when they find something that works? They double down. How can we make the posters scarier?
Oh.
And so lots of symptoms, lots of people dying in the posters, not just scary ghosts and, you know, scary messages on the billboards. But, and the same thing happened again. 6 months of decreased or holding steady infection rates, and then 6 months again of rising. So we knew that we had to change things. So we started off asking the question, what are the tools we have at our disposal? And it started with the condom. So, okay, what do we know about the condom? From an innovation standpoint, it hasn't really changed that much. In fact, the condom, how old would you think the condom is, Sarah?
Be at least a couple hundred years.
So we find the first evidence of the condom painted on the side of a French cave. in the Grotte Carambel 10,000 years ago.
Holy cow.
So we have no idea whether or not this cave painter was, you know, creating a public safety message or whether or not he was bragging about last night's exploits. But needless to say.
And she's married, but she won't get pregnant from me.
Right. I mean, and then we really have to think about, did people actually know what they were doing when they had this lambskin bag, right?
Well, they had to. I mean, well, maybe not, because I think about the Jewish responsibilities to keep clean mm-hmm. back during the time of the original Black Plague, mm-hmm. and it kept them from getting sick, but they sure. didn't necessarily know that washing their hands before every meal, cleaning their beds to get the fleas and flies out every Friday for the Sabbath, they didn't know that that was keeping them from getting sick.
That's right. That's right. So we knew that this tool that we had, right, if you think about it in tech parlance today, right, this was our innovation and it was 10,000-year-old, right? 10,000 years old is this
right.
tool. So we realized, what else do we have at our disposal to change? What was actually going to change behavior? And we recognized the only thing that would make people change was the story and the incentive. But at first, it came down to the story. So what was a different story we could tell besides get AIDS and die? And we realized very quickly that we had to make the listener the hero of the story. So shifting the perspective from A, the condom, or B, the disease, how do we make it all about the listener? And we had three target audiences: the mama-san who owned the brothel, the John who was coming, you know, for pleasure and entertainment, and the sex worker herself. So to the mama-san, she was interested in profit. To the customer, he was interested in pleasure. And to the sex worker, she or he was interested in survival. And so we had to shift the narrative to allow these folks to see a bigger reality than just the mercenary one in front of them.
Right. I just was thinking that the shock and awe is great for a market shift, but it's not going to create a culture shift.
That's right. And it also means the market shift can change quickly,
right?
Prevailing voices can come in when you preface a message on just fear. Another fear message can come in very quickly and knock it out because it's not grounded in the reality of the listener. The listener right. hasn't right. internalized the fear fully because we're craving a different reality that isn't so tense.
Right, right. We want some consistency and
yeah.
safety.
And we want some relief from the fear. We mm-hmm. actually want hope and optimism and something better than that. So to the mama-san, we said, protect your reputation and your investment. Offer condoms. To the John, we said, be the hero of your family. Be the protector of your family. And to the sex worker herself, we said, own your destiny. Now, the average sex worker was in that employ for roughly about 2 years and would then go back home to her village, get married, have kids, no real social stigma. Very different from here. But to her, we said, in order for her to wear a condom, to use a condom 8 times a night, 8 different customer interactions a night, not very comfortable, not very easy, not always very compliant. Their customer doesn't necessarily want to use one. We had to allow her to see a future for herself that was brighter than the one she was currently living, the survival mode. And that was own your own destiny. And that's where the incentive part came in. So working for this, the largest nonprofit organization in Thailand, a Thai organization, we began to set up programs that would turn prostitutes into entrepreneurs and help them with job training and job skills that would allow them to open their own small businesses. Mm. And with that, they saw a future that went beyond even going back to their own villages and doing what their mothers and grandmothers had done before them. And that opportunity said, it's worth it for me to demand using a condom with every customer every time. And we rapidly saw infection rates drop. And so that was a shift. That was a shift. Right. It wasn't easy, but it was a shift. So fast forward, working now, I came back to Thailand and I wound up working as an epidemiologist at the Centers for Disease Control doing AIDS research in New York. And then I went on a miserable blind date with a senior editor at Forbes magazine who complained to me about these horrible PR people who were constantly interrupting him while he was trying to write his Pulitzer Prize winning stories. And I thought, the tech boom had taken off. It was 1999. I was fascinated by what was going on in technology, but I had no desire to get a software engineering degree. And I thought, maybe I could become one of these tech PR people. I had an AOL account. How much more did you need to know about technology? Poor thing. So with that, this editor at Forbes, you know, the date ended about 15 minutes in. And he said, but you know what? You and I are going to be friends for the rest of our lives. And I thought, I don't even think he showered for this date. I don't really know that we're going to be friends. And sure enough, he came to my wedding. I went to his wedding and I became the publicist on his first book.
Wow.
He went on to introduce me to one of the PR firms that he's, as he said, he loathed the least.
Oh.
And I wound up working for this agency. And so I, you know, kind of cut my teeth on learning how to become a tech publicist at the height of the internet boom, where technology and cool new products and dot-coms were all the rage. And it was a fascinating time to be in tech.
Wow. And I can see how you can apply all of those lessons from cultural anthropology and what you see in culture change and culture shift by participating in it. I could see where that all comes together in just this beautiful connection, like a tapestry almost.
Well, it's certainly Silicon Valley and Silicon Alley in New York are very different cultures, from the one that I had been accustomed to up in, you know, the hill tribes of Northern Thailand. But it's a culture nonetheless. And when you begin to understand it and why it works, Silicon Valley is predicated around great technologies that are going to change the market. But this is where the innovation storytelling kicked in, is that most innovators are really great at innovating and they have incredible vision for their product, but they have such a difficult time, oftentimes, conveying the value of that innovation to the rest of us. Mm-hmm. Because it's their job to pull us into the future before we can even see it. And that is where storytelling is your best weapon to get us to understand what's coming next. Otherwise, the genre of sci-fi wouldn't even exist, right? Thankfully, you know, George Lucas and Isaac Asimov and lots of other folks have guided us into a future that we couldn't even imagine for ourselves.
Right. Right. They took us along for that ride. And now so much of it is in true existence that we use every day.
That's right.
Crazy.
That's right. But, you know, there are ways of, so often where innovators get stuck is they say, look at this beautiful new thing I built. It's an incredible box and it has all these buttons on it and these antennas and it does all these crazy things and I built it. And you want to see the box? I can't wait to tell you about the box. And just going, great box.
You know? Well, and that's true for messaging around everything, is that we have a tendency to talk about the product itself or the service itself and not necessarily the value that somebody who buys it or uses it is going to get out of it. I think that's so common because we get so excited about what we're creating and what we want to share with the world. And what I keep seeing in this parallel is you have this story of innovation and being able to tell Star Trek story, you know, one of the many Star Trek stories, in order to bring people to actually visualize what is being created in our world right now, and telling the stories around the emotional context of these creations, like a phone that you can use that doesn't have a cord, right? And being able to have those doors open and close without anybody touching them. That was a big deal, you know, to see those automatic doors. And that was decades ago, and we're still seeing these wonderful and oftentimes very scary stories of what our future might look like. And so I love that. And then the parallel that I see is when a leader is leading an organization and they want to inspire people, they have a tendency to tell a story that they find inspiring, but it's not necessarily their own. And so they don't necessarily reflect their audience. And if you want an audience to resonate with your message, you have to reflect that. You have to reflect them. So being able to tell a story of why this mattered to you. Mm-hmm. So for instance, I have a cousin that I went to, we were at an event together last year, and he said that he was going to be giving a presentation on this new HVAC technology that was really high efficiency. And he was so excited about this. And he said, I just don't really know where to start and how to tell the story. And I said, well, why are you interested in being efficient? Why does that matter to you? And he goes, well, I've always been interested in the environment. I said, like, since when? And he said, well, when I was 6 and my sister was 8, we celebrated the very first Earth Day, 1970. And this is what we did. And we had this little booth and we were talking about this. And I was like, that's the story you tell. That's your audience will be like, oh, that makes so much sense. Now I know why he's so excited about it. And on top of that, it helps them think about why they're in their business. Why do I care about it? Gosh, that story reminds me of the time that I did A. Mm-hmm. That's why I keep seeing our parallels of your innovation storytelling in the corporate world and my innovation storytelling with leaders. Oh, I just got to chill. That's so cool. So cool.
You know, I usually work with chief innovation officers and their teams, right? So they have some new box that is going to change the world. And, you know, we try to take them on an understanding of how this works, right? So first there's the mindset, which I know you do too, around storytelling. With innovation storytelling, I try to give examples of the greatest viral storytellers in history. So I was a double major in cultural anthropology and religion.
Oh my goodness. That's a busy major.
The greatest viral storytellers of all time are Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, Moses. And why is that? It's because we're still telling their stories thousands of years later. They're gone and we're still telling these stories. Why are we doing that? Well, there could be some, you know, extra help from on high for sure, but they told stories in a very specific way that got us to retell them. And so my curiosity was like, how did they get the message to spread around the world? And so figuring that out, it became clear that number one, when you're telling an innovation story, you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You don't discard your history where the innovation came from. That's step one. So recognize the parts of the past that are still relevant today. So we call it email because we all know what mail is. When we add the E in front of it, we get it.
You know? Electronic. Right. Yeah. It describes it. Right.
You know, I don't know how many of your listeners actually think about that little save button, you know, when you're saving a document in Microsoft Word, but ask your kids if they can identify what that save icon actually is. You know, it's a 3x5-inch floppy disk that we used to use to save our term papers on in 1992.
Why is that still the icon? I guess because it works. People remember it.
Right. And this is the way we actually get the very ancient human brain into thinking about something new is we provide it with a pathway, a bridge to get from the old to the new, right? So that's step one. Don't throw out the history. Step two is asking yourself what kind of prophet you'll be. So for your leaders, right, and my innovation leaders, these are people who have to, if you're really going to usher change into the world, you have to walk the walk and talk the talk, meaning you have to own the innovation and you have to be able to talk about it. So let's figure out how you're going to communicate in what way. And the third piece is now is figuring out the message. How will we actually convey what this new thing is, right? If I'm Steve Jobs, I'm bringing you the iPod, and what can I tell you about it? I'm giving you 1,000 songs in your pocket. And this is where we actually begin to burn the bridge now behind us. We have to be very clear with the listener that there is no going back. We will not go back to Walkmen. We will not go back to giant MP3 players that have a CD player attached to it and a radio attached to it and 500 buttons on it.
We with will a giant boombox on our shoulder.
Yes,
from the hip hop days.
And by the way, Steve Jobs managed to convince us that 1,000 songs in our pocket was better than all of the songs in our pocket, right? With the old MP3 players that had a CD player on it and a radio and our MP3, we could have all of the music in the world. Serendipitous discovery, our favorite CD collection, anything we downloaded from friends. And yet he convinced us that fewer songs, our favorite songs, we're going to be even better than all the songs. So a really good message is so compelling. Yeah. And then we have to figure out how to make the message move, right? So 1,000 songs in your pocket is memorable. You know, alliterative language, language that really resonates with the listener. But not only that, it allows them to share it with somebody else. Innovation needs movement in order for the innovation to take hold. So you actually have to package a message with language that allows you to walk out of a meeting and get somebody else to share it. Can you remember it 6 minutes later? Can you walk down the hallway and be like, oh my God, I just heard this really cool about this really cool invention in my last meeting. You have to hear about it. If I'm talking in bits and bytes, I can't share it. If I'm talking in statistics and Excel spreadsheets, no one will care or remember, right? And then the last thing is step 5 is the early adopters. Who are those people who will take the message to the masses in your organization or outside the organization? So it might not be the loudest person in the room. It might be the biggest skeptic. But can you organize a group of people who will become the biggest cheerleaders behind the innovation and be able to put it in their own words, right? The reason we're still sharing Bible stories and Talmudic stories all of this time, right, is because we found a way to make it our own. We applied it to our own life. And we said, my life is forever changed and I won't go back. I am living proof that this machine works, that this new innovation works, and I love it. You should try it.
It makes me think of Malcolm Gladwell's The Tipping Point.
Mm.
It was one of the 5 top books that changed the way that I think about life in general, and the connectors, the salespeople, the mavens, and how we can be all 3, but also making sure that the ambassadors that you select or that self-select are the ones that are going to reach their audience effectively. And I think we could talk about this all day. This is such an amazing conversation. And I would really like to revisit this again, maybe in about 6 months, because I can see things shifting as we go through these weird changes in our global community of coming back to some version of what we had before. I'm not going to call it normal because I didn't think it was normal before. And then having to shift back again when the virus comes back, which is pretty predictable that it'll come back in the late fall. So I think in 6 months, this conversation will be even more relevant, or we can take it a different direction and talk about the messaging that we've received that hasn't worked versus has worked and the changes in behavior and culture. So if you're game, I will schedule another call in a few months. Are you up for that?
Yeah, heck yeah. So, you know, I'd love for your listeners to be on the lookout when they're on LinkedIn or they're scrolling through Facebook or even just listening to the news. Are the prophets, right, of our coronavation, right now. Those people who are bringing in, you know, those ventilators who are jerry-rigged, you know, from rubber bands and MacGyvered, right?
Right. I love that, MacGyvered.
Like that. Or, you know, those masks that are cut out so that people who are, you know, hearing impaired, they can actually read lips. Or what are the coronavations that you're seeing during this time that are really helping people? And the other is, are the prophets, right, who are bringing them into the market, are our leaders in the market, are they effectively able to explain what the future looks like for all of us? Because those are the people who we want to follow, who are able to repeat that to our moms and our grandmothers about what's happening around them, and to our children, right? This is the place where we're communicating health information to our family members and our friends now. And only when we get clear directives from our leaders can we then share it effectively with one another. Right. So look out for those coronavation prophets at the right moment.
Really, and look out for the messaging that is hopeful. Mm. Look out for the messaging of the future that you want to see. And that's the thing that I keep coming back to, is the doom and gloomers and the super positive optimists. It has to be somewhere in between. And I like to listen to people who talk about the future in the context of, this is what I would like to see, and this is a future that we can really wrap our arms around. And those are the storytellers that I would like to be following.
Agreed. Me too. Yeah. And hopefully more and more. And I would encourage people who have that, you know, mindset and those insights to be the prophets, right? Be the ones who are sharing those messages of hope and clarity and the understanding about what's coming next. We're going to have a whole slew around vaccines and everything else. So there's a lot to be learned for leaders in business and leaders in the health sphere.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And for our listeners, on the show notes, on the blog post associated with this podcast, I will have Susan's contact information and her website so that you can see more of what she's done. I just love the story that you told me during our last conversation about ultrasounds from GE and the way that came about. So if you are a listener and you are fascinated as I am by this woman and her adventures, please reach out to her, connect with her on LinkedIn. I encourage you to ask the questions. So thank you, Susan. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much. And I hope, you know, my book on innovation storytelling will be out in August. So hopefully there'll be more to share with your listeners then too.
Oh, that's right. I forgot to plug that. So in August, great. Innovation Storytelling, coming from Susan Lindner. And I will have the name of the book and, again, probably a website so that you can sign up for updates about the book. I'm sure she'll have an email list going so that you can receive updates for when her book comes out in August. And congratulations on that. So
thanks exciting. So much. I can't wait to read yours.
Thank you. Very soon.
Take care, Sarah.
Thank you for listening to Your Stories Don't Define You, How You Tell Them Will. If you're planning an event or company retreat and want to bring in a memorable, entertaining, and highly practical speaker as your keynote speaker or workshop facilitator, please visit us at elkinsconsulting.com to learn how we can help and provide a memorable keynote or breakout session. Thank you. I look forward to hearing from you.
Listen to me, honey, while I say, how could you tell me?